listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. In less than a decade, President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal agencies radically transformed Los Angeles, as they did other American cities, in a successful but largely forgotten effort to extricate the nation from the Great Depression. In addition to building the region's cultural infrastructure of schools, libraries, and museums, the Federal Writers Project left us a vivid freeze-frame description of what Southern California was like before World War II. In reading David Kippen's delightful introduction to Los Angeles in the 1930s, the WPA Guide to the City of Angels, I thought of a letter from my father that I recently unearthed. It was written in 1941, just 2 years after Union Station opened its doors, the year that the WPA Guide to the City of Angels was published. That was the year that my young father rode the Empire Builder from New York City to Los Angeles, arriving at Union Station on a beautifully sunny afternoon, entranced by the smell of orange blossoms. My grandfather picked him up in his blue Studebaker, and they drove up into the Hollywood Hills, where they watched Yasha Heifetz rehearsing at the Bowl. My father fell in love with L.A. that day, which is why I didn't grow up in the Bronx or Brooklyn. He was soon shipped across the Pacific to combat horrors in Luzon, returning forever changed, and the shock of World War II, as David Kippen reminds us, also became the WPA Guide's undoing, quote, because few had the time or gasoline anymore for its sightseeing tours. David Kippen is a writer, a native Angeleno, and a man who deeply loves Los Angeles and its culture. Until January 2010, he was literature director of the National Endowment for the Arts. He also served from 1998 to 2005 as book critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. In July 2010, and I'm sure many of you here have visited Libro Schmibruf's, correct? Are you any? Yes. He opened Libro Schmibos, a lending library used bookstore in the once majority Jewish, now majority Latino neighborhood of Boyle Heights. Los Angeles in the 1930s and San Francisco in the 1930s, the two recently republished WPA guides for which David wrote the introductions, are a legacy of the Federal Writers Project of the WPA. Tonight, David discusses the WPA legacy in Los Angeles, both literary and architectural, with historian Dr. Gray Brecken, currently a visiting scholar at the UC Berkeley Department of Geography, from which he received his PhD. Dr. Brecken is the founder of the Living New Deal, an effort to inventory and map the legacy of the New Deal public works in the United States. He's also the author of Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. Historian Kevin Starr called Imperial San Francisco breathtaking in its argument, scholarship that is thrilling in its comprehensiveness. I think you have a real treat in front of you. Please welcome Dr. Gray Brecken and David Kippen. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank Union Station. Or Louise, as she said, might not be here. That's one of the most beautiful train stations in the country, I can say, because I ride Amtrak quite a bit. And Union Station is just, well, other than Penn Station in New York, it's probably the greatest. And of course, we don't have Penn Station anymore. Well, I thought I would talk about New Deal Los Angeles and the area around it as the writer's guide talks about, because it's not just Los Angeles. Of course, it's all of Southern California. But I wanted to show you some of the things that you're not going to find in the guide, because it really doesn't talk very much about what the WPA and the other New Deal agencies like the PWA and the CWA and the CCC did here. And so I'm going to just give you a taste. I'm just going to scratch the surface of some of the incredible changes that happened to Southern California in just a few years of the last Great Depression. Okay? Well, let's start out with Maggie Thatcher. She recently played, of course, by Meryl Streep, or vice versa. She did it so well, it's hard to tell. But here she is with one of her buddies, a guy whose family's bacon was saved when his dad got a job with the WPA, and then she and he became pitchmen for the exact opposite. In this case, neoliberalism, privatization, deregulation, commercialization of everything. And they were very successful at that. So it's very hard now to remember what it was like before that time. Margaret Thatcher was prone to say so often about what she was doing on her side of the Atlantic and her buddy was doing on our side of the Atlantic. She was said so often, there is no alternative, that Britons acronymed that as TINA. There is no alternative. But what if there was?
I propose to discover a world much like our own in a parallel universe.
That is heresy.
That is the truth.
Well, we once had it, actually, and it actually worked. Contrary to what its enemies have told you for so often, that it didn't work. The solid line is what happened to GDP from the moment that Roosevelt came in. It starts going up sharply, and unemployment dropped sharply until things looked good enough in 1937 that Roosevelt felt confident enough to start turning off the federal faucet and toss the country into a horrible recession until he turned it back on again. And a large part of that is because of the massive public works projects that came along with the New Deal, the WPA, the best known, but Public Works Administration, CCC, all of them. And they changed the country. They essentially pole vaulted it out of the 19th into the 20th century. Now, if you want to find out some of what was done in Southern California, you can go to our Living New Deal map online. And this is just the beginning. We're still discovering an incredible amount of stuff. It just happens all the time. And I hope you'll help us. If you see WPA marks on your sidewalks in your neighborhood, let us know. Now, the New Deal actually starts just 6 days after, just 6 days after Roosevelt's inauguration on March 10th, 1933, when Southern California is rocked by a major earthquake centered in Long Beach. And it wrecked the Long Beach schools and many others, Santa Monica, Los Angeles, etc. And they were in luck because very soon, the Public Works Administration would be formed by Congress and under Harold Ickes, and it would just move in and in 3 years completely change and modernize the Los Angeles, Southern California school system. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. This was Jefferson School, and this is what replaced it. And you see these, of course, all over L.A., and I'm going to come back to this later on. Here's the L.A. River in flood, sweeping away the infrastructure, the WPA and the CCC, these men were trained for disaster aid and then prevention. And then the Public Works Administration, of course, came in and, as you see, did a great deal. They changed all the hydrology. They laid an enormous amount of infrastructure that most of you have come to take for granted and are unaware of. So here's what they did on that particular site. They rebuilt the infrastructure. This is Hanson Dam in the San Fernando Valley. They began building the detention basin so that when the floods come, you wouldn't be buried in boulders and mud. It still happens on occasion. Here's the scenic LA River, and after the Public Works Administration got finished with it. Now, of course, environmental issues weren't high on their priority list. What they were really trying to do was to lay as much concrete as possible and basically kickstart the construction industry again. And it was very successful in doing that. This was a vast project, as you know, actually, from what's happened to the watercourses. This is one of the great storm drains on Slauson Avenue. Every time I'm down here in the winter and a gully washer happens, I think the only reason that LA isn't in the Pacific is because of all this stuff, which most of you never think about, you know. Woe be to, you know, the arroyos and everything else, but there it is. It represents a colossal taxpayer subsidy to the developers, who were then able to build right up to the edges of the water streams, sometimes actually on top of them, and into the floodplains, etc. Along with concreting the LA and other rivers, it built viaducts, many of the viaducts that you crossing the LA River. Here's the Aliso Way Viaduct under construction. And it paved roads and built sidewalks. This is Bundy Drive. And again, this is a taxpayer subsidy. Because, of course, as soon as this went in, developers would then just cover the hills with houses at taxpayers' expense because of this infrastructure. This is the Fletcher Street pumping station. They gave you safe and clean drinking water. This was a modern pumping station. Here's the water plant in Pasadena. Here's a water tower in Torrance. And here are the great water tanks that gave clean water to Long Beach. These are WPA workers. That's a WPA sign. They're laying sewers. So they laid sewers all over the place. And so when you flushed away this water, of course, it would go someplace where it would be relatively safe. And they created sewage treatment plants all over the place. So within a few years, at the beginning of Roosevelt's term, a minority of Americans had safe drinking water. 6 years later, virtually everybody did. And we've been taking it for granted ever since. This is Laguna Beach. They also built civic buildings. This is the Fullerton City Hall, the Torrance City Hall, and Glendale on dedication day. And I think it was 1941. It was a late building. And it's still there. It's been butchered on the inside, but on the outside it looks pretty much the same. Burbank is great. I mean, Burbank looks like Ginger and Fred are going to come down the stairs at any moment. It's pristine. They built a tremendous number of recreational facilities for people. And in San Francisco, we found that the WPA improved every park in San Francisco, and I suspect the same is true in Southern California. They just moved in, but they didn't leave any markers, or very few of them. This is the Glendale Recreation Center, pools, auditorium, et cetera. You're looking up at Glendale Community College, which they partly built as well, too. Here's the college with a fountain done by WPA workers up there. And just so that it wouldn't all wash away, they concreted the Verdugo Wash at the same time. So here's the WPA or the PWA, I'm not sure, working on that. And here it is scenically today. As I say, they built parks and recreational facilities. The whole Arcadia Park was built by WPA, the golf course, golf club, the swimming pool, the baseball diamonds. They didn't leave any markers. Huntington Beach got a modern recreational facility right on the beach. Beverly Hills, not to be left out, got tennis courts lighted at night. And as long as we're in Beverly Hills, let's go over to Beverly Hills High with that famous zip code. And here is the swim pavilion at Beverly High with, fortunately, a plaque on it, which tells you that this was built by the Roosevelt administration. It was an emergency project. I doubt that the kids there today know that. They did the rock abutments at the Rose Bowl. And much of the work in Arroyo Seco was done by WPA workers, including the concreting of the stream itself. That's a WPA sign up there. They put those up everywhere so that people would know what their tax dollars were doing. They gave us our airports. Most of them have vanished because we've expanded the airport so much, but Long Beach is still pretty pristine. And they recently uncovered this wonderful WPA mosaic of a zodiac upstairs. And there's mosaics on the floor of seagulls. If you haven't seen it, you should go over there and see the Long Beach Airport. They did a lot of historical preservation. This is a Mission Asistencia out at near Redlands that the WPA restored. That's a WPA work sign there. Here it is today. It's very popular for weddings and other kinds of events. And if you look at that plaque, says it was a WPA project. And those are what we're always looking for. Unfortunately, they're vanishing very quickly, if there were any, because, of course, copper thieves take them. I'm hoping I can get one myself, as a matter of fact. but I'm not going to go to great lengths to do that. This is a book about things that the Public Works Administration did. It shows the commitment that the New Deal did for universal public education, and they used the Hollywood High School as an illustration. Because the rebuilding of the Southern California school system was one of the largest public works projects, certainly in this country, and it was just colossal. And Southern California, or California, I should say, in general, because of the passage of the Field Act after the Long Beach earthquake, got a plethora of the most modern schools in the country. Now, again, we come to take them for granted. This is one of the schools being seismically retrofitted. They did do this to some of the schools that they felt that they were salvageable. But in most cases, they just tore down the school and then rebuilt it, in some cases entire campuses. This is what a modern school should be like. And again, we came to take these things for granted. They come to us largely from the New Deal. Things like a room for conservation, art rooms, multi-purpose auditoriums that the whole community could use, cafeterias. We even had WPA nutritionists at that time so that the kids would know what to eat. It's all passing away, of course. This is George Washington High School after the earthquake. They came in and built an entirely new campus. Here's the library with a fine WPA mural. The lobby with petrochrome artwork, WPA artwork of the father of our country. Here's Virgil's school, and still exactly the same. Susan Dorsey over near Compton, a wonderful modernist building. You can scarcely see it now because there's so many trees around it. Thomas Jefferson in Compton. San Pedro High School. You've seen these all over the place, of course, but you probably don't think of them as New Deal and that they form a kind of a matrix. One of my favorites is Hollywood High, as it was the PWA. It's a marvelous building. Here's an interior archival shot with the light coming through. Hollywood High, if you look up on the where the frieze or the cornice would be, but they didn't have cornices because they'd fall off in earthquakes, it has inscriptions in English, Latin, and Greek. And the purpose of this was to let you know that with public education, you could get an education as good as you might get by going to Exeter or Groton. You know, that was what public education in California should be, and it should, of course, be free. Long Beach Polytechnic, which has marvelous WPA art in it. If you can't read that, speed is the greatest factor in modern life. Emerson School, which is by Richard Neutra. They gave us our junior colleges. This is Long Beach Community College getting started. And then they give us civic lessons as well, too. They actually speak to us. This is Hoover School in Whittier. And what you see as you approach it is this statement. What you would have in the life of a nation, you must first put into its schools. That's not Alexander von Humboldt, it's Wilhelm von Humboldt, his brother, the founder of public education in Prussia, which is why Germany became a great country in the 19th century. This is a WPA-built library in Torrance, and it has an inscription on it which you can't read, so I'll enhance it. Knowledge is that which, next to virtue, truly and essentially raises one man above another. Now, I know that that's an elitist statement, but we'll just let it stand. And then Long Beach Polytechnic, the students go under a copper marquee that says, enter to learn, go forth to serve. It's all about public service in the New Deal. This is the Upland City Hall, built by the WPA. It's a line from Virgil. The noblest motive is the public good, which is also on the WPA-built county administration building in San Diego. The noblest motive is the public good. If I could think of any slogan for the New Deal ethos of public service, it would be this. And it's not just that they speak to you overtly, they do so indirectly too by the quality of their materials and the craftsmanship of them. This is Washington Middle School in a tough part of Long Beach. The walls are paneled in mahogany, a striated mahogany. The floors are a beautiful aquamarine terracotta. The railings were all brass, and it had a stenciled ceiling on it with that wonderful deco chandelier. Somewhere along the line, it was all painted over. And then a remarkable principal came in to take over this school. She rescued it because she realized what she had, and she had it all stripped. And when we were looking at it, she said to us, you know, poor kids need beauty as much as rich kids do. In fact, they needed a lot more. And those kids adored this woman. She really turned that school around. But it was partly because, you know, she realized what they had, and she let the New Deal speak to those kids now. And then I just want to show you a few of the federal art projects because they haven't left much trace. We're looking at the physical stuff, but we can't help, since we're David's going to talk about the Writers' Project, the four elements in the WPA that stimulated arts all across the country. The Federal Music Project brought both traditional and new music to people here. It's at the Hollywood Bowl, which they improved by adding night lighting, and I think they added some of the gateways there. This is the Southern California WPA Orchestra, which brought classical and other kind of music to people. This is a Mexican Típica band. And this is a transportation facility which actually took music, WPA music, to people who had never heard live music before. And this was either free or very cheap. Then there was the Federal Theater Project, which also gave people repertory theater as well as experimental theater. This was under the inspired leadership of Hallie Flanagan. And African Americans, for the first time, got opportunities to act in plays that were designed for themselves. And then there was the Federal Art Project, the one that's best known because it left a lot of stuff, which is all over the place. This is towards the end, just before the WPA is killed. And finally, Harry Hopkins, who was in charge of the WPA, is having open houses because the WPA is really on the ropes, and he wants to show people what it's doing for them. This is a mosaic at Southgate Public Library, which I've not been able to photograph. This is a petrochrome huge mural that was on the Long Beach Auditorium, which was demolished, but they saved this, fortunately. Petrochrome was a new kind of technique that was invented by Stanton McDonald Wright, and here he is working on one, which is in the Santa Monica City Hall. This was a remarkable WPA mural, which is out at Duarte at the City of Hope, and fortunately, it's still there. This is really over the top. The Getty would love to get its hands on this thing, but fortunately they're not giving it up. They almost did. This was the only WPA artwork that we know of that was in this library. It's mentioned in the guide. That's how I found out about it, and I just found out this afternoon that it was rain damaged. It was one in the children's court, and it was rain damaged, and they painted over in 1962. So no trace of it left anymore. Now, to get to the library itself, they built libraries all over the place as part of this aim for universal public education, democratizing education. I don't think that other than that artwork, anything like that was done for the LA library, the main library. But I'll bet that there was a lot of library aid because they hired a lot of, particularly women, to do clerical work for the libraries. And so when you use the library, especially when you use primary materials, you're often unwittingly standing on the shoulders of WPA workers who put that stuff in order. So here we have, of course, the great atrium here with its murals, which look like they're WPA, but they're not. And I just wanted to use this because so many of our libraries, our public libraries, and our university libraries, such as mine at UC, are now in desperate straits because they simply don't have the money that they need to function to do what they're supposed to do. So the question then comes, is there still room for the public? Because what the New Deal was about was an enormous expansion of the whole idea of the public and what the public should be in a democracy. And do we actually need that? Do we need public libraries when we have this? Why don't you just buy your book and everything else along with it, along with a Kindle, of course? I leave that to you. But let's wrap up with those just, you know, quintessentially public buildings, our post offices. The New Deal built, in order to put people to work, it built over 1,100 post offices around the country. And they're often the finest buildings in many small towns. And now they're up for sale. And so at increasing rate. Redlands Post Office, wonderful building, on the National Register, up for sale. Beverly Hills Post Office, I believe, has already been closed. This is the one in La Jolla, which sits on some extremely valuable downtown real estate. It has a marvelous mural on the inside. Its fate is uncertain. And this is Santa Monica. On the inside, no murals, but look at the craftsmanship and the materials. And then Venice, the Venice Post Office, with that great mural by Edward Bieberman of Abbot Kinney and the scene in Venice during the 1930s. Well, the people there in Venice, fortunately, are not taking this sitting down. They're really putting up a fight. This is a mural that Bieberman did for the main Los Angeles post office in the federal building. It's since gone missing. You can see that it was a bit controversial at the time. for obvious reasons, and nobody knows what's happened to it. But we do know what's happened to the mural, his mural, at the Venice Post Office. And so this is a flyer for a recent protest at the Venice Post Office. And here are some of the people putting up a fight to try to save that post office. Now, the folks down in La Jolla believe that they have a friend because Senator Feinstein has friended them on their website about saving the post office. And I'm glad to hear that because Feinstein is in a unique position to help anybody that she chooses to, because it's her husband's real estate arm. Her husband is Richard Blum, the billionaire. Her husband's real estate arm, C.B. Richard Ellis, a year ago got the exclusive contract with the U.S. Postal Service to sell and lease our post offices, our real estate. That's a real estate portfolio potentially worth billions of dollars. And this is just another example of the enclosure of the commons, of the property that we all own. So I just wanted to let you know that there is an alternative. Tina is a lie. There is an alternative. You've just seen it. Here's a guide to much of WPA. And now we'll have something more upbeat from David. And please go to our website and just explore. Thank you very much.
God, that's a tough act to follow. I'm inclined to think that whatever good's been done by University of California Press in bringing this book and its sister book, The WPA Guide to San Francisco, and mercifully, shortly, The WPA Guide to San Diego and The WPA Guide to California, back into print next year, also with introductions by myself, I'm inclined to think whatever gift they've given to Los Angeles, it's as much of a gift to have you down here and show us that.
Oh, thank you, Dave. It's great to be down here. And I should say that because I grew up in Northern California, I was raised from the cradle to hate this place. I had an epiphany somewhere along the line. I realized I love this place.
We actually did a version of this dog and pony show up at the San Francisco Public Library last year, shortly after the book came out. And of course, as happens so often, San Francisco does it first and LA does it better. But I just want to start by saying I went to Beverly Hills High School.
Oh, you did?
I swam in that pool.
Okay.
And I didn't know it was a WPA building.
Didn't you see the plaque?
They shouldn't be plaques. They should be billboards. They should
exactly.
be copper
yeah.
billboards. Uh-huh.
I agree. But you can see actually how corroded that is. Nobody cares for it. Whereas down at San Diego, there's a fire station where the boys go out, I think, every day and polish the WPA plaque on it. It shines like the sun.
Well,
you know what you're going to be doing tomorrow?
Yes, absolutely. Depend upon it.
Yeah.
Let me just preface this by saying, because I'm afraid I'll forget it later, the WPA is so unsung around the country, of course, but certainly here in Los Angeles. And I'll buttonhole anybody who will listen to me and tell them, and maybe you have an idea what would make a better one, but if we were going to christen another WPA monument, we could do a lot worse than to take a bridge that I wouldn't know was WPA unless you'd included it in the San Francisco slideshow, which is the bridge with the inspiring name of the, I believe, Glendale Boulevard First Street Bridge. you know, when you go out First Street past the DWP building and the Disney Hall, you're headed west, and you go over Bridge. And weirdly, when you get over the bridge, you're not on First Street anymore. You're on Beverly, although First Street picks up again, and people don't know this, runs all the way out to, like, Pan Pacific Park and the Beverly Center. I would love to rename that bridge in honor of, I mean, you tell me, Francis Perkins, Harry Hopkins.
Ooh, yeah.
But, of course, I should say that it wasn't just bridge builders and stonemasons and artists who were out of work in the Depression. It was also, as they are today, in altogether too many cases, it was writers. I mean, for writers today, the Great Depression's back. But the Depression, as always, is so much worse in the 1930s. And, of course, the federal government found the wherewithal to put many writers and many non-writers who became writers and who were subject to withering contempt by the people who were already writers, but thanks to their editing and their prodding, became terrific writers in their own right. All of these scribblers who worked for the Federal Writers Project, the FWP, were put back to work. And of course, the first thing the federal government did, and I feel like I understand this because I worked for the National Endowment for the Arts for 4.5 years. We created this program called the Big Read, which helped cities and towns across the country create these one city, one book programs that, you know, a couple of cities had done really well, and a lot of other cities without a great library, without, you know, time to do much more than, you know, pick up the trash on time, hadn't been doing. But one of the first things that we did with the Big Read was we made sure that there was one in every state. And once we had that, we started to make sure that there was one in every congressional district, because, of course, without Congress's support, you're not going to get very far. And, you know, I look at this, and I see the exact same motives at work, and blessedly. So around the country, you had these wonderful offices. I mean, in Chicago, you guys want a historical novel just waiting to happen? Around the same water cooler in the Chicago FWP office, you had Richard Wright, Saul Bellow, Studs Terkel, Nelson Algren. I mean, imagine. Chicago Guide is really a wonder, but the LA Guide is absolutely marvelous. It wasn't quite as star-studded, but you had, anybody know who Carl Foreman was? Carl Foreman wrote High Noon. He was blacklisted, so the 50s were kind of an off decade for him, but he worked on the WPA Guide. If you read the Hollywood section, the screenwriting section, the film writing section, I won't look it up right now, but there's wonderful stuff about how you know, screenwriters get rewritten, and you just know, you can feel his heartbreak because he's writing from, you know, personal experience. Harry Partch, does that name ring a bell? Wonderful composer, avant-garde composer, product of California, terrific writer, which not enough people realize.
I know that.
Yeah, he worked on it. I mean, he's one of not a whole lot of writers who are mentioned by name in, I forget if it's LA or California or both WPA guides, but so many writers, like so many artists, like so many artisans and architects, went unrecognized. There was a modesty to the writers' guides, and I wish some of the informed self-interest that went into putting these projects into every corner of the country had gone into memorializing them, not just with plaques, but with mention in the guides. But they are truly wonders to pick up and read. And the great thing about the LA Guide, you know, in addition to the fact that it's beautifully written, and I recommend the San Francisco Guide too, because Kenneth Rexroth worked on that, so that one is also wonderful. But the thing, you know, if you ask a San Franciscan, if you could step into a time machine and visit San Francisco in any era in history, when would you go to? You get all kinds of answers. Mm-hmm. You know, you get the gold rush, you'll get, you know, the San Francisco Renaissance in the 1950s with the Six Gallery and Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg. You get all these interests because, you know, San Francisco has been a consistently you know, fascinating and erratic roller coaster of a town with booms and busts. And not that LA hasn't been that, but if you ask an informed Angelino if he could go back to any time in LA history, I'll bet you'll get something approaching a consensus. And that year is 1939. Mm-hmm. That was the year that Raymond Chandler invented Philip Marlowe at book length in The Big Sleep, the first of the great Philip Marlowe novels. That was the year that John Fante, the great poet of downtown Los Angeles, and Bunker Hill, who you know, whose novel Ask the Dust is one of the great testaments of 1930s Los Angeles, that was published in 1939, was a sensation, then went out of print, and was rediscovered in the main reading room of this building by Charles Bukowski, after which it went back into print and has stayed there ever since. And Day of the Locust by Nathaniel West, 1939, 1 year. And that was the year that this book was researched, came out a year or two later. So, in lieu of a time machine, we've got this book. And, you know, self-aggrandizing it probably is to prop up my copy here, although not self-enriching, because this is a fee-for-service, and but buy the book for the University of California. Interesting thing, by the way. You know, it says so much about California today that they came out with the L.A. Guide and the San Francisco Guide first, because in 2011, there's so little state consciousness. I mean, where are you from? You're from Los Angeles, right? Go up to San Francisco. First thing you hear is, well, I'm a San Franciscan. Or maybe they say, you know, I'm not an Angelina. You hear that too. but nobody defines himself as a Californian practically. That was not the case in 1939. I've been working on the introduction to the California Guide, and it's plain that, you know, they say the minute you know, there are minor sectarian differences, but the minute you disparage an Angelino or a San Franciscan, he makes common cause with his neighbors up and down the state and will defend California and trumpet its praises to the sky. Well, you know, it's not the case anymore, to my mind, sadly, and at great cost to trans pan-Californian institutions like the University of California. But in 1939, you had a different perspective. And so what I love about this book is it gives you a trapdoor into 1939 and what was going on in the city around you. So I commend it to you for that. I commend the San Francisco Guide. I think there's a real reclamation project to be performed. And what I love best about this book is that, yes, it's a time machine. Yes, it's a flashback and a trapdoor. But it's also a challenge. Mm-hmm. It is a reproach to people who would forget all that was accomplished in those years, by the writer, sure, but by a country that was flat on its back and resurrected by a whole lot of really dedicated people, but I think first and foremost, the ultimate WPA, PWA, CCC acronym, FDR, whose button is on Gray's lapel. What does it say?
We want FDR again. Yes.
You'll notice there's no date on the button.
Four terms.
So let's have a conversation and then go up to round eight and then welcome you guys into it.
Sure.
How did you get started how did you begin to get interested, or perhaps a better word would be obsessed, with the WPA?
Well, I was an undergraduate at Cal, and the Berkeley Rose Garden is just a place of complete enchantment there. It's an amphitheater of thousands of roses, and it has one of those WPA plaques on it. And so everybody would go up and watch sunsets up there over the bay. But I got really interested in that plaque. And I was going, you know, WPA, you know, what's this? You know, why would a government agency build something that's just absurdly beautiful, you know, just for the public? And so I guess that's what sort of got me interested. And then after I finished Imperial San Francisco and Farewell Promised Land, which are incredibly depressing books, and took a lot out of me, so I was looking for a project that would be a little bit more fun and upbeat. So a friend of mine, Bob Dawson, the photographer, and I, we decided we would go around looking for WPA stuff. And what anybody who gets into this quickly finds out is there are a lot of other agencies, and they did so much stuff. There's no way you can get to the bottom of it, and you certainly couldn't do it in one book. And then I realized we were living in the 21st century. I hadn't noticed, and that there's this new technology where you could have interactive site like that where you can constantly add to it, which is very unlike a book, obviously, which is a finite amount. And then we expanded a couple of years ago to the National Project, and I now know what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life, and I'm very happy about it because it's such an endlessly fascinating project. I liken it to a huge archaeological dig of a civilization which my parents built and then we buried and forgot about. And how could this happen? And especially when these artifacts are so gorgeous. And it seems like a tragedy, you know, because it, as I said, you know, it's not just artifacts. It's a whole lost ethical language which we have largely ditched.
And you're working on a book about that, aren't you?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Not just the quotations, but the kind of language in the 1930s that the quotations gave rise to.
What do those inscriptions say to us, you know, when you go into a building like that? What do the What does the craftsmanship and the care go into? Because you don't see that kind of stuff anymore, except in maybe in private buildings.
I'll give you one exception.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That proves the rule to my mind. But this building,
yes,
after it burned, mm-hmm, probably a lot of us were part of the bucket brigade the next, mm-hmm, morning. They created that little garden on 5th Street. And like my favorite quotation of all time is there, because there are all these quotations about book burning. And there's a great quotation from, I think it's Rabbi Akiva.
Mm-hmm.
Go out and look at it. I think, you know, like there's a standpipe next to it, maybe some, you know, shrubbery grown over it. But, mm-hmm, you know, squint, trespass, get a look at it. It says, the pages burn, but the words fly away.
Mm-hmm.
So what don't people know about the WPA? I mean, what glimmer of recollection do people have of it when you go around and talk about it? I mean, is there some residual interest, or do you find, you know, frequent total cluelessness?
No, there's been a lot more interest in the last 3 years because, you know, the Maggie and Ronnie basically wanted the market to rip, and it did, especially 3 years ago, it really ripped. And so I have to disagree with you a little bit because, mm-hmm, like Paul Krugman says, we are in a depression. It depends on where you are. If you go out in the San Joaquin Valley, they are in a Great Depression. And most of us, you know, avoid that place. But they're desperate out there. And so in the Bay Area, because of Silicon Valley and other stuff, we don't notice it quite so much. But anyway, so there's begun to be real new interest. Of course, when Obama came in, there was a lot of, because of the crash at that time, there was that famous cover of Time magazine where, you know, he's riding in a convertible with a jaunty cigarette holder and a fedora, and they're likening him to FDR. So there began to be a lot more interest. There have been a lot of essays on, we need a new WPA. I would say even more so, we need a new civilian conservation corps for young men who really need some work. So, I mean, you know, we've got the precedent. And it worked. That was the point I was trying to make. It worked. The lie that the New Deal didn't end the Depression, the war did, is just that. It's a lie. It did work. And it worked brilliantly. And I took advantage of that. We all did, you know, because after the war, it didn't end with Roosevelt's death in 45. People like Lyndon Johnson and Pat Brown were old New Dealers, and they brought it into the 60s. And when I went to Cal in 67, I went there because it was free. And I got this great education, which I took for granted. I mean, I'm as guilty as anybody else. I took it for granted that I could get a free education. That was your birthright as a Californian. Well, the students today certainly don't take that for granted. But all of that is from, you know, that communitarian ethos of the New Deal. And I'm just... I want to pitch one to you. I mean,
sure.
Why do you think that so many, why were they so humble, you know, that they, you find almost no mention? As I said, that mural that was here is, I think, one of only two mentions of the Federal Art Project in that book.
Well, I mean, I alluded earlier to the sort of canniness of the way they tried to put WPA projects everywhere they possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
They were thinking of the present. They were thinking of ensuring the furtherance of the New Deal. But there was also a kind of modesty about it. They wanted the program to survive, but they didn't necessarily want to sign their names to it. I mean, you see it in these guides. You know, they list an editor. You know, maybe they list the supervisors.
Mm-hmm.
But the pieces are totally unsigned. And boy, is there a great reclamation project waiting to be performed. I only wish I had the time and the wherewithal to curl up with the boxes of the WPA files at UCLA in the Special Collections Department. You can go there, you know, present some sort of identification that says you're not an arsonist, and they will show you these boxes. Some of them began to be cataloged years ago by a great scholar at USC who's working on a book about Boyle Heights named George Sanchez. Mm-hmm. But it's the barest outline of what's in there. And I maintain that if you went through them and you had, you know, not my untutored eyes, but, you know, one of these guys like Don Foster who, you know, can look at a manuscript and tell you Joe Klein rather than an anonymous wrote it, or, you know, Thomas Pynchon wrote these letters and not some... Thomas Pynchon didn't write these letters, some crackpot in Humboldt County did. He's a literary detective. I think if you looked at these typescripts, you could begin to get, maybe not 100% certainty, but you could hazard a guess as to who wrote what and begin to recover some of these names that through modesty from below, but also, diktats from on high, from Washington. And boy, I mean, regardless of who sent these memos, there's just some wonderful sort of sniping back and forth in the grand journalistic tradition between, you know, editors and the brass, even if the brass was, you know, well-intentioned, brilliant bureaucrats without whom none of this would ever have happened. Mm-hmm. I just want to hold up the original guide. I mean, I love this one to pieces, but this is what the original one looked like. 70 years older, it's in great shape.
Oh yeah!
Look at the cover. That's a
Federal Art Project.
That's I think a Biberman mural that you can go see. It's at the courthouse here in downtown Los Angeles, Federal Courthouse, and it's gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. It's a funny story actually about this, about the UC Press book. I adore UC Press. I loved writing the introductions to these two guides. I'm loving writing the next two, but they sent me their mock-up of this jacket. I'll just hold it up so people can see it, especially our God-given Gary Leonard, without whom we wouldn't even recognize ourselves here in Los Angeles. They sent me this mock-up of the cover early on, and looked great. Looked exactly like this with one exception. Right here, where there's a gorgeous vintage postcard image of Union Station, it was a vintage postcard, beautiful image of the Terminal Annex Post Office. I know you love post offices, and I love the Terminal Annex building, but basically, the Terminal Annex is right across the street from Union Station.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the equivalent would be cover of the San Francisco Guide. You can see it out there. It's from the Rincon Post Annex, Office murals of, you know, great sort of socialist realism images of guys riveting the Golden Gate Bridge together. So basically, putting a Terminal Annex post office on the cover of the WPA Guide to Los Angeles, I emailed my editor and said, it's beautiful, but it's kind of like if you put a vintage postcard image of the Oakland Bay Bridge on the cover of the WPA Guide to San Francisco. It's across the street from the most beautiful building in the city. But yeah, I mean, look at these two books. They're indestructible. Mm-hmm.
David, I was thinking about this humility because, and I think that's part of the ethos of the time because I read somewhere, and I wish I could find it again. It's just sort of lost in my notes. I had wondered why it's so difficult, like for the buildings that they built, to find out who the architects were. Because in 1933, 90% of architects were out of business. And then these New Deal projects give them a lot of work. And yet, if the architectural magazines I've consulted don't give it much credit, which I think is really kind of ungrateful because of all that it did for them and did for us. But I read somewhere that they wanted the workers on the buildings to feel that they were as important as the designers of the building. And I didn't believe that until, the more I've looked at that post office art, I think the San Pedro post office, which has a wonderful mural of mail processing. Now, when before that were workers in a building who do everyday work, when were they able to see themselves heroized as absolutely essential components of a civilization, as they are there? But to go back to the Rincon post office, I've studied those murals quite a bit. They're, I think, the greatest New Deal artworks in the country. And I've been researching the Anton Refregi's papers in Washington at the archives there. And it's an extraordinary story. On that mural, which he shows the building of the Golden Gate Bridge, he moves the designer of the bridge over to the corner. And so he's not prominent. It's the workers who are building the bridge. And when you think of, we just celebrated the 75th birthday of the Golden Gate Bridge, and you see those men working up there. Yes, they were heroes, every bit as much as any soldiers, or Marines on Guadalcanal. Those guys were risking their lives every day to build that gorgeous thing. And so I think that's the difference, that we're all in this together. That was the ethos of it.
I've been in a few newsrooms over the years, and you don't always get that ethos, and maybe that has something to do with why, you know, you don't see the typesetters mentioned, you don't see the copy editors mentioned in the WPA guides, but, you know, every scrap of information we should be grateful for.
One of the, as I say, in the guides, you very seldom will read about the WPA. An exception is the guide to New York City, which is great.
Yeah.
There are several of them, actually, because New York was just the center of the universe, so except for this place, of course. But
and who worked on that? I think John Cheever was in that office.
Yes, I think so. But it was only in that guide, that I found out that the WPA restored a big green statue out in the harbor. So they did all the landscaping on Liberty Island. So I went out there to look at it one time. There's no marker that they were there. All I found is a photograph of a WPA worker working on the torch of the Statue of Liberty. But other than the guide, you know, it's one of the few mentions I've ever had of that.
Are there big gaps that you're hoping to fill in the Living New Deal project? I mean, are there whole states or at least, you know, parts of the country? I mean, obviously California is, you know, probably the most thoroughly researched, although nowhere near
because
completely.
Of what we've done, we've got a 1,200 information points.
1,200 information
points. As I say, we'll never get to the bottom of it because we haven't really even started tackling what the CCC did.
Mm-hmm.
Huge amount of work up in the San Gabriel and San Bernardino Mountains up there.
With, you know, grant money enough and time, would you hope to tour not just California but the country?
And well, that's what we're doing now.
Oh, good.
You know, we want to show Americans a very different country. I sort of lust for getting a feature in the National Geographic of New Deal America because I want to not only involve people all around the country in this great archaeological dig, but I want them to see the country in a very different way. And it's really inspirational when you get into it. We've prioritized right now a mapping New Deal Washington, D.C. so that the denizens of that city will know that they're largely living in a city that was built by FDR. And then I want to do
including Ronald Reagan Airport, if
exactly,
I'm not
mistaken. Yes, that was a PWA project. I've managed to get in there. Yeah. The last time I was there, it's a wonderful building, and they tried to keep me out, Homeland Security, you know. But I managed to penetrate their defenses and got in there just before they dragged me off.
You ought to see the WPA guide to Washington D.C. if you haven't.
I haven't seen that. No,
it's a brick.
Uh-huh.
This thing weighs like 5 pounds. And it's like, you know, the jacket must be made of, you know, molybdenum or something. And it's, you know, it's incredibly detailed because, of, you know, this is what do they call it? Federal One, which was the home office of the Federal Writers Project. And, you know, a certain self-absorption, I guess, goes with the territory. I should also, speaking of you know, uncarryable books, I should mention that you know, in the late 1940s, I think, early 50s, after the WPA had been pretty much red-baited out of existence, Hastings House, the inheriting publisher of a lot of these guides, brought out not just reissues, but an omnibus edition that purported to basically gather between covers some of the information, a lot of the information, from all 50 state guides, and the only way that they could squeeze it in between covers was like one word in every three is an abbreviation, and the paper is like just about transparent. That's how thin it is, and it's still 1,500 pages long. Uh-huh. I used to take this with me in my suitcase. It was about the heaviest thing in there when I traveled around the country for the big read, which I was incredibly fortunate to get to do, and, you know, go to like 40 states. And one of the first things I did, you know, just honoring the passing of Ray Bradbury, and he talks about his road trip across the country from Waukegan, Illinois, where he was from, to Southern California. And, you know, they would pile into some town late at night and find a motel. And the first thing Ray did was he'd run to the public library and look for Oz books. But that's kind of what I did when I was going around the country, except I would look for the post offices. Yeah. I would look for the WPA architecture.
Good for you.
There. Mm-hmm. It's there. Mm-hmm. Still.
Didn't Steinbeck take the guides with him?
Yes, he did. And actually, I think a flurry of renewed interest in the WPA guides after years of neglect came in about 50 years ago this year when Travels with Charlie came out. And I commend, don't believe what they say, that Travels with Charlie was late Steinbeck and it's not as good as The Grapes of Wrath and of Mice and Men. It's doing something very different. But this is an incredibly sophisticated book. I mean, just, you know, the chapter in the hotel in Chicago with Lonesome Harry. I'm not going to tell you anything more about that. Just find the Lonesome Harry chapter. Brilliant. There's a paragraph in there where he says, you know, I mean, I've got it in the introduction. I'm not going to waste time looking for it. But basically, you know, it held a mirror up to the country, and nothing before or since has ever been its equal, the WPA guides. And that became a blurb on a lot of university press reissues of WPA guides. But these babies haven't been out since an early reissue in 1951. Mm-hmm. So get them while they're hot. But let's, more importantly, let's have some questions. Yes, sir. No, that's you. Nobody behind you. Nobody but you. Oh, yeah, we're talking. Oh, right, you guys are going to do this, and I'm just going to, we're just going to sit back and luxuriate.
Thank you so much. I just have to tell you that I was in the Venice, trying to get in the Venice post office on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. It was locked. No signage, but they had closed it and ended up opening up their new office about a block away. So by stealth means they did away with any more controversy by just closing our local post office. I had things to mail. And so it's done. It's a done deal.
Yeah.
But the mural will be saved somehow or other. One question. We have a Congress that it's at odds with each other. In 1933, did any Republicans go along with the WPA? Was there an attempt to overturn the WPA over the next 4 or 5 years?
Well, first, Republicans in 1933 were quite different from the Republicans. They were reasonable. And there were Republicans who could engage in bipartisanship and were rational, you know. And but Roosevelt had such a landslide in 33 and then again in 36 that he pretty much had a rubber stamp Congress. So it wasn't really a problem up until 38. That recession that I showed you changed a lot of stuff because it was called FDR's recession or even his depression. People were terrified that they were going back into the depression until he turned the tap back on again. And so a lot of Republicans came in 38 into Congress, and it wasn't so easy after that. A lot of people feel that the New Deal sort of ended at that time, and they did try to. Well, the first thing they cut back on was the Federal Theater Project because it was so controversial. And Tim Robbins did a wonderful film about that called Cradle Will Rock. And it's about all the events. It's not so much about the play itself, because I've seen the play, and it's different. But it's about the events around that. And the beginning of the witch hunt and what happened was, David said, a lot of the people who were just so jazzed about what they could do in the New Deal, because it was like the windows had just been open and the fresh air had come in. And it's the beginning of what becomes the McCarthy period. But they had to wait until Roosevelt was out of the way in 45 before they could really get going on that. I mentioned the murals at former Rincon Post Office in San Francisco. Those were so controversial because the Hearst Press was going after that hammer and tongs, and the artist was getting death threats while he was on his scaffold. And in 1953, those were put on trial in Washington. I found the account in the Congressional Record. It's going to make a great play or an opera someday because it's so incredibly stupid because it not only put the art on trial, it puts history on trial itself. The way that he depicted history was put on trial. It's just fascinating. Mm-hmm. But you get that in this kind of wonderful art.
Yes. Jim, a question. I was through the 1930s, mm-hmm. and I did want to answer one of your questions, and that was why the WPA had so many people on it. The reason was we had building and loan societies here. If you were a mogul, mm-hmm. you put your money in building and loan, and you were called. Mm-hmm. You had to give every cent you owned to that building and loan society when they were going broke. Mm-hmm. And so that meant that people who were moguls were out there hod carrying, and we didn't have any ready mix concretes, and we didn't have any concrete pumpers. Mm-hmm. You had to carry loads of concrete. And think of those big concrete buildings. They were all built by people working. And that's what they needed at the time, lots of people at work. And nowadays, when you don't use so many people at work, there is a question whether we could use a WPA again. Mm-hmm. But I did want to say that because I did live through it. I watched those buildings being built, mm-hmm. and it was really something for this town. But my question I had was, there was another part of our history down here, the Mission Bells, the road, the Mission Road, and we all had these little bells that were up. And lately, you see them now, especially on I-5 and on 101. And I was wondering, are you researching those out and seeing who is putting those up, and are there going to be any more put up?
No, I don't know. I think that was the job of the state, I believe. And did those go in earlier, do you know? Was it 1915 or so? El Camino Real was finished.
I was thinking, somewhere I got the idea it was on the anniversary of the...
I didn't know that.
I think the ones that we've been seeing all our lives went up on the anniversary of the Portola expedition, but I could be wrong.
The state rushed El Camino Real to completion in 1915 to connect San Francisco with San Diego, largely to get people to move to California, which they did. So it might come from there, but I'm not sure. But to your point, there are two big construction projects. PWA is the kind that Obama did, basically encouraged. It's trickled down through contractors. It's grants and loans, and that was in the Interior Department under Harold Ickes. The WPA under Harry Hopkins, who was a social worker from Grinnell, Iowa, they deliberately, as you say, de-stressed heavy equipment. And you're right, that by having manual labor, that's one of the reasons that they were able to employ 8.5 million people and doing really hard work, as you say. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I had a question. I was looking at all of the wonderful sayings, and the whole concept of the public good, which I don't think J.P. Morgan probably ever had before in a prior generation, and I don't hear anybody talking about it today. Was that an anomaly, do you think, for that period? And what was there a final death knell for WPA? Was there some legislation that just finally killed it, or was it the recession, the next recession that came in?
I think it's an anomaly in the U.S. It really took the Roosevelts to talk about the public good and sort of embed it in people's minds in that way. You hadn't really had it before, and we haven't had it really since then, except for maybe Johnson's War on Poverty, which, as I say, is sort of an extension of it. Let's see, what was the other one?
Was there legislation that killed the WPA?
CCC dies, they put it out of its business in 42, and WPA dies in 43. And that is because there was full employment during the war, and there was no need for any kind of emergency relief, work relief programs anymore. So pretty much all of the programs were gone by the middle of the war. And I think that's one of the reasons we know so little about it, because after the war, there was nobody around anymore to sort of sum up everything that they had done. And a lot of this stuff just got sort of pushed into archives, like the one you were talking about. And that's one of the things that is so exciting about it. It's like discovering Herculaneum or something. There it is, you know. Make of it what you will.
I've always been impressed by the photography in the WPA guides. I'd like to know if any well-known photographers got their start or got a boost.
Absolutely.
Through their work in those
I lavish
books.
A couple of paragraphs on that. It's a good question in my introduction. And the photographers, unlike most of the writers, actually get bylines. They get credit. And if you look through the Los Angeles Guide, there are a couple of photographs apiece credited to Edward Weston and Julia Shulman.
Hmm.
And there's a photograph by an absolute no-name that I lavish a couple of graphs on, picture of a parasol library in Pershing Square. Did you know that the LA Public Library used to have three branches outdoors? Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful stuff.
You know, I've wondered whether the WPA had its own photo division, but I've never... It must have. The photographs that you're really familiar with are by the Farm Securities Administration, and that was another great visionary, Roy Stryker, who had the idea of taking good photographers, and he made them into some of the best documentary photographers of all time, my favorite being Dorothea Lange. Perhaps that's because she lived in Berkeley. No, I think it's really because she was such a great photographer. But that's in the FSA. I found that the New York Public Library has a great collection of her photographs because Stryker, well, in that period after Roosevelt's death, he was sending FSA photographs to the New York Public in brown paper wrappers saying that there were congressmen who wanted to destroy these because they made the U.S. look bad. And please keep these until people want them. And so they've got a great collection of photographs there.
You showed a couple of controversial images before, but were there any kind of class divisions stirred up in a kind of NEA or Helmsian way with writers getting funds and artists getting funds and people saying, oh, look at these worthless artists and writers getting
Absolutely.
Funds?
Absolutely, yes. You know, the term that you hear from that time is boondoggle, that, you know, this was all boondoggle, that it was just, you know, guys pushing leaves around in forests and things like that. But you want to talk about that?
Not in great detail. I mean, I'm, you know, mm-hmm. you're the historian up here, and I'm just, you know, a lucky guy who got a good gig. But no, actually, the only thing I can contribute to the conversation is the real derivation of the word boondoggle.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's that little sort of bolo tie that Boy Scouts have, fastening the thongs around it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. I can mention one guy, and that was William Randolph Hearst, who probably the last progressive thing that he did was he backed Roosevelt in 1932. He came to regret that because Roosevelt instituted a progressive income tax, and he felt that Roosevelt had stabbed him in the back because that really put a crimp in building San Simeon. and so he turned viciously against Roosevelt. In one of his editorials, he said, "The Roosevelt administration is more communist than the communists themselves." And the Hearst papers were uniformly vicious towards the whole New Deal.
Yes, hi. This is a marvelous presentation. I'm enjoying it a whole lot. The part that I'm a little bit worried about is neglect of our infrastructure. You know, you talk about dams and this type of thing, and it seems like we keep putting these issues off and off, and then you have these floods and natural disasters, and I hate to say it, but Katrina. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, and it's so politically charged, who's going to step up and try to address these issues in the future in the White House or Washington, and if you have thoughts or comments.
Well, I certainly notice that because, as I say, I take Amtrak across the country every couple of years, and it's just dramatic to cross the Rust Belt and see hundreds of miles of closed and shuttered factories, and imagine what that's done to those cities like Toledo and Buffalo, et cetera. That's where they are in depression. And you see that the bridges are just falling apart, you know, and as you say, nothing's being done about it. The American Society of Civil Engineers periodically issues a report card on the American infrastructure, and overall, the United States now gets a D. And our dams get a D because in many states, there's not even any dam inspectors anymore. So it's just a matter of time. China is going in the absolute opposite direction. They're building incredible infrastructure all over the place. So I leave it up to you to imagine what's going to happen, because there are elements in the Congress that will make sure that we don't have infrastructure.
Can you speak briefly about the Federal Art Project, which was responsible for the monument to the astronomers at the Griffith Park Observatory and other works?
Do you know, David?
I'm almost certain that was a WPA project.
It was a WPA project, but I don't know who the art sculptor was.
Oh, God, I mean, you hear it. Yeah, Hugo Balin.
Hugo Balin?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
One of the great things about, you know, going on the trail with Gray is, you know, we meet people who know more about this stuff mm-hmm. than we do, and it's a constant education for us. We were up in a convalescent home in Marin, and a guy stood up. You remember this guy?
Yeah.
Who said, I worked in the WPA. And, it, you know, I got chills.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I think we made him stand up and take mm-hmm. some applause because, you know, there are a couple of people left. And if you see one, I mean, you know.
These people have got to be interviewed.
Oh, yeah. God, yes. You know, the phrase that gets thrown around in military circles, and rightly so, is thank you for your service. But you just want to buttonhole the last guy mm-hmm. and say thank you for your service to yeah. America.
I had an unforgettable experience a couple of years ago. I interviewed a 95-year-old woman who is one of the last living New Deal artists. She lives in Western New York in the country, and her mind was still sharp as a tack. Mm-hmm. She painted a mural for a post office in Michigan. She and her husband painted the murals for the Social Security building in Washington, and then she painted this mural in Michigan, and she said as soon as it was mounted, the postmaster tore it off the wall. And I said, well, why did he do that? And she said, well, I guess it was because I showed blacks and whites working and playing together. And as a matter of fact, in the Refrigerator mural in San Francisco, that's one of the things that the Hearst papers attacked him for, is for showing Negroes as playing part of the history of San Francisco, which had never been seen before in public art there. People simply didn't know. Sure.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. Oh, let's go on longer.
I have a comment and a question. Mm-hmm. The comment is that I read somewhere a couple of weeks ago that the Venice Post Office has, in fact, been bought by a Los Angeles billionaire for his own company, and that he has promised to keep the part that leads to the mural open, to preserve the mural, and to keep the hallway that leads to the mural open to the public. So I don't think that particular issue is an issue anymore. I could be mistaken, it may not have been finalized, but what I read made me feel that it had been finalized. Mm. The question that I have is that so much money was poured into the New Deal, especially the WPA, by the federal government, it's hard to believe that there are no government archives about where the money was spent, whom it was given to, no?
I have heard and half believe that there was a willful attempt to disperse the records of this program so that you know, people wouldn't fully understand what they had and lost. I mean, I'm not given to conspiracy theories, but I've researched this, not looking for, you know, stories of conspiracy, but just looking for the papers. And the National Archives tells you to go look at UCLA, and UCLA tells you to go to Berkeley, and Berkeley, you know, tells you to look someplace else. Whether through connivance or incompetence or just, you know, the mists of time, too much of this record is probably not lost, just, you know, like a crate at San Simeon. At the end of
Citizen Kane.
Nobody knows where uh-huh. to find it.
Yeah. I will say something about that art, though. I am very worried about the postal art because they say that they're going to preserve it, but there's nothing to guarantee that it can, and I and several other people have been stopped several times from photographing our artwork in the post offices by either postmasters or clerks who said, that artwork belongs to the U.S. Postal Service. And I stage a scene, and I say, no, my parents paid for that. It's in the public domain. It belongs to us. It's a hazy issue. And if the USPS actually can claim ownership of that, there are some artworks, like by Ben Shahn, that are probably worth more than the building and the real estate that they're in. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if very soon those artworks also get commodified, and they could be put on the market. And I really worry about that.
And let me just add, because we're having too good a time, and the only way to prolong this is to keep the answers to the questions mm-hmm. as long as yeah. possible, because mm-hmm. we're about to have our last one, mm-hmm. Is, you know, this book is a bargain at $24.95, but... its contents are free. If you Google it, you can find the entire text of this book. And the reason for that is because your parents and grandparents paid for it, mm-hmm. and it's yours. And my wish is that some other billionaire, somebody in Silicon Valley, will find a way to gene splice the information in the WPA guides to California and Los Angeles and San Francisco and every city and country, city and state across the country, and gene splice them into a GPS so that you can drive around and actually know what you're looking at any given moment.
Mm-hmm. How you doing, Mr. Bricken? As somebody who goes around and actually photographs post offices and schools, I've recently run across a guy who said he was in the CCC.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, when you run across a guy like this and you want to interview him and put it on YouTube for availability, I mean, what kind of questions do you ask?
Boy, that's a great question.
Yeah, and I'm no authority on this, but, you know, first, you know, the first answer, the short answer is hurry. The second answer... the second answer is just get them started.
Yeah.
Because I've, you know, the CCC in particular, the guys who rebuilt La Purisima Mission near
Lompoc.
San Luis, near Lompoc. Mm-hmm. First of all, go see this. It's a miracle. They put to work not just, you know, stonemasons, but architects and
archaeologists.
And
WPA artists.
Putting it back to work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the CCC guys who worked on it. I'm doing a little work on this in my intro to the book I'm working on about California State Parks. Most of these guys in the CC will talk about it as the most fulfilling moments in their lives. You know, these are like half of them inner city kids who are sleeping under the stars and you know, playing cards around campfires and getting paid every night for doing honest work for the first time in their lives. And they cherished it for 60 years, 70 years after. And if anybody's left, they cherish it now.
It sure beat starving, riding the rods, going to prison. You know, the New Deal had this queer notion that it's a lot cheaper to educate people and uplift them than to punish them. Weird, you know. And so I found that, you know, they built thousands of schools and they built very few prisons. What an odd idea.
Well, I half suspect that this is, you know, sort of morphing gradually from a panel into a filibuster. So I want to, we should probably round it off.
Oh, no.
No, we should probably continue it outside where we would both be delighted to sign some of our books. And I should tell you, you've probably been to events like this before. You've had writers inscribe their books and, you know, they hand you the book back and you read it and that's nice. And 30 seconds later, it's over. If I inscribe a book for you, you're going to spend the next 20 minutes trying to decipher my handwriting. So you get a lot more enjoyment out of one of my inscriptions.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.